Gentlemen, thank you again so much for making some time with us to be in the studio today. Good to see you both.
All right. Thank you very much for having us.
You bet. And I want to take some time eventually and get to sort of where we're at in this whole long process, some of the things that are going to be coming up next, and what folks can expect here on the ground in terms of other action that's going to be happening or presumed to be happening here pretty soon. But you mentioned some of the global things that are going on, because as we know, LNG is not just something that comes out of our backyard here in Alaska. This is very much a global marketplace, and we're dealing on a big scale in trying to get this project off the ground and find customers for that North Slope gas. And so I guess the way to kick that off would be, we heard late last week, LNG tariffs being added to the list from China, and I know you've addressed this in multiple places already, but have to ask, you know, this ongoing kind of tit-for-tat trade thing with China, as we look at what it's doing for steel resources, what it potentially could be doing for some export products down the road. What are the thoughts on this? How does this impact how AGDC thinks of this project, or are these things kind of viewed as a little bit short term and they're not really a huge factor in the planning process?
Well, maybe to cut to the end, it's a little bit short term. We say when this project gets in service, I think all of the tariff issues and discussions will be behind us. But let's step into it a little bit more than that. First of all, when we look at LNG globally, it is a growth market. So it is natural gas. Natural gas is the cleanest hydrocarbon on the planet, just CH4, very simple molecule, easy to break down, and therefore is very clean to burn. The fastest growth market in LNG worldwide is China, and it's largely because of market share. And what they're doing is retiring a lot of the coal plants and replacing them with natural gas. So they've become now number two importer in the world, but on a very, very rapid growth pace to get there over the last 10 years. Worldwide, the LNG is becoming much more of a fungible product, a product that is easily moved around and traded now. We now have about 40 import countries that should be in place by the time this project comes into being. So that's been a very significant growth. It's become very easy to become an LNG import nation. And so as countries look to where they're going to get their fuel for power generation and other things, natural gas becomes a much more viable alternative than it was. When you add the environmental impact on top of that, it would have been easy for a lot of those nations to go to coal first, like a number of countries have. But instead, they're leapfrogging that and going right to gas because it's become, again, much more easy to obtain, much more simple. There's no technology risk anymore with LNG. So it's an accepted hydrocarbon fuel. Asia is the fastest growing market. China is the fastest growth market within Asia. We've got some good relationships there. When President Trump was elected, he turned his attention to trade issues. So we sort of made a little bit of a shift away from environment, more toward trade. And when we look at trade, we look at Asia as being an imbalance and China as being really the greatest imbalance within Asia. What China has said really to the U.S. is, hey, we want to buy more stuff from the U.S., but we want to buy the stuff we need. Well, it turns out that LNG is one of the things that they need. And it turns out also that the United States, particularly with the shale gas developments going on in the lower 48, is one of the products that the United States can sell. So when President Xi met with President Trump in Florida last year, they decided, okay, LNG was going to be one of those things that's a good fit for both. The U.S. can be a good seller. China can be a big buyer. During that meeting with President Trump and President Xi, the Alaska project was mentioned. We had done quite a bit of work with VP Pence, with Commerce Secretary Ross, with Interior Secretary Zinke. They like this project. It's a big construction project, big infrastructure project, and when you're all done, it's a big export project. So that was mentioned, and then when President Xi left Florida and was returning back to China, he stopped in Alaska with his entire cabinet. So we had a very good meeting and a dinner meeting. He got to see the nice blue skies of Alaska, also got much more comfortable with the project. So we gave him a very thorough, he and his cabinet, a very thorough overview of the project. That led to a number of meetings and them sending some teams of people here to Alaska to really study the project, the route, the resource base. And they really, really, you know, we formed a very good relationship that led to the signing of the Joint Development Agreement back in November, on November 9th, in front of President Xi and President Trump. They both witnessed that signing. Now, since then, the trade issues have picked up. You know, the talk on trade tension has picked up. United States has elevated that a bit. China's, you know, sort of tit for tat. And now recently, LNG has been mentioned as one of the things that may be impacted. So it's not yet, but maybe. So it's something we're watching.
And what would that do to the LNG exports? Essentially, it doesn't really change the price sort of on the production end and the export end if China puts some tariffs in place. It makes that gas more expensive for customers on that side of the supply chain. Do I have that right?
Correct. Right. It would be an impact to the Chinese consumer. Now, relative to other projects, it could somewhat disadvantage the U.S. projects.
And now I'm curious, and we might kind of jump around here a bit as we're talking about some of these bigger scale kind of things and kind of the global market for natural gas. But I'm curious, you know, what do other countries? British Columbia has exports online. Russia has exports online. Now, how do these all play and affect the market with China? I know, especially with Russia, they're turning increasingly to the Asia Pacific market, and China in particular is a place for growth and a place where they can sell their very large supplies of natural gas, much the same we are. How does that impact the market and influence the thinking of putting this project together here in Alaska?
Well, Asia is a big demand, and so as a consequence of that, all of the suppliers have Asia in their sights. So Russia has just recently brought on the Yamal project, which is way in the north on the Yamal Peninsula, which is way west in Russia. It's got quite a ways to go to get to China. But
Very long ways to go.
Yes, it does, but it can get there. So they've now become, in service. They're producing it higher than their nameplate, so it's been a successful development for them. British Columbia wants to be online, so they're not yet. They're not yet in construction. They also have a pipeline over the mountains like we do.
Right.
Difference is they don't have existing roads or that type of thing to follow. But there is one project in particular in British Columbia that looks like it's getting some good traction. So we're keeping an eye on that one. But then you've also got other projects like in Papua New Guinea and Mozambique and a couple more in Australia. Everybody wants to get to Asia and specifically China. We have some advantages with our route. We're direct. We don't go through a third nation or a Panama Canal or that type of thing. Relatively short shipping distance, about one-third as compared to the U.S. Gulf Coast. But it is a competitive market.
And I'll throw out kind of the obvious question here, and we touched on it briefly, is China is aiming to get away from using coal for electrical generation and trying to use more electricity just in general to power their economy, so to speak. But China doesn't have much natural gas of its own. Otherwise, it clearly wouldn't be looking for all these exports. And are there other, the Asia-Pacific market, and China in particular, is a huge potential growth market. Are there other areas that would be targeted or that could potentially become customers of AK LNG exports?
There are certainly Japan is number one LNG buyer. And interesting to note, the first LNG cargo to ever reach Japan came from Nikiski, Alaska. Mm-hmm. So the Japanese Tokyo Gas in particular has a saying that Alaska gave birth to LNG, but Tokyo Gas raised it up. And now they're quite a mature buyer of LNG. So they've got import terminals all the way around the country. So they're still number one. Korea was number two buyer in the world. They've now lost the number two position to China. China has now built 16 LNG receiving terminals, so they've got quite a bit of import capacity and growing. Now they're starting to build out the pipeline network behind those terminals so they can take more gas in. So those are sort of the three top logical parties. Singapore is another big one. When you look at other emerging markets in that greater Asian region, though, you see places like Vietnam. So Vietnam is not currently an LNG importer, but they have plans for three terminals. So we've also signed an agreement with Petrovietnam Gas, which is national-owned company, and that agreement was also signed in front of the President of Vietnam and President Trump, who came to Vietnam right after China. Then you've got some big markets, big potential markets like India. So India still burns a lot of coal. India intends to continue to burn a lot of coal. They've sort of told the world, hey, you guys had your coal days, we're going to have ours. But there's a big potential LNG market. Now, for us, India is a little bit challenged, financially, because we're really looking at a project finance company, which means we have to have very good long-term creditworthy customers as buyers. Not that the Indian companies don't pay their bills or that, but many of them on paper are not really bankable. So the India, I think you're going to see more go to the existing sellers that already have facilities built, like the Qataris, let's say, that do not need the credit support. So for us, it's those traditional LNG Asian buyers with a couple of emerging countries that we know are going to be big buyers.
Now, I'm really curious. I mean, in addition to just the simple idea that demand for energy isn't going anywhere but up anywhere around the globe, it's just always going to go up and up and up. Are there specific things within that you can point to as developments or policies or long-range goals of other places and other markets that will help drive that demand? Or is it just simply more people, more demand for energy? Or are there, can you dive into that a little bit and see specifically what's driving that demand?
I can a bit. And part of it is maybe a shift to this cleaner hydrocarbon. And one of those sectors really to watch is in the transportation sector, which has long been held captive by the petroleum sector, right? Gas and oil. What you're seeing now is this electrification of the transportation sector, where you're getting electric cars. They're now trying electric trucks. China has actually talked about a potentially implementing a policy of forbidding hydrocarbon fuel or gasoline-fueled cars or diesel-fueled cars and going to electric vehicles. Well, that electricity has to come from somewhere. And so currently a lot of the electricity is coming from hydrocarbons. Now, there is, renewable sources as well, solar and wind, but on a percentage basis, those are very small. And so what we're looking for there, too, is really not so much a change in total demand, but rather a shift in how their energy is getting to them. So on the vehicles, if that electricity, is going to be the fuel for the car, well, then we need to have the fuel for the electricity. And again, as we're seeing, that natural gas becomes the hydrocarbon of choice for those cleaner, more environmentally conscious nations.
It's interesting to think about some of those markets, the Chinese market in particular, and how they view the use of natural gas and how they view their power generation and what their needs are going to be for the future. And then you can kind of almost juxtapose that to what's going on in the United States, where despite this glut of natural gas, we're seeing a push for all sectors of energy production to be sort of revitalized. This ongoing push to keep coal plants alive when around the world, they're slowly being phased out. And so are pushes like that seem to avail themselves of the political winds of the moment, are those roadblocks, are those issues that you have to think about a lot in terms of getting this whole project online?
I would not call them roadblocks. I think one thing that is important to highlight, coal sometimes gets, a bad rap because coal can be burned very dirtily, right? Very dirty. But coal can also be burned cleanly. And so you hear about clean coal, and it involves a lot of capital cost on scrubbers, stack emissions, that type of thing. So coal burned in an environmentally responsible way is fine. It's just, a lot of places in the world do not use that. They don't want to invest in that capital. And so you have a lot of dirty coal. You've got a lot of that in China. In Beijing, they have weather days that are toxic. A lot of the weather that toxic particulates in the air go up in the air and they come down in the rain. That rain goes in the ocean, and the Alaska islands, the Aleutians feel that. I mean, they see it in the health of their fish. And you see it all the way here to Kenai, but particularly as you look west in the island. So to me, the United States is really sort of under Trump has really pushed all hydrocarbons are okay. So that means oil, gas, and coal. You know, he says he digs coal. Well, so do a lot of other people in the United States. And right now, the United States could not do without its coal-fired power plants. You know, we've got a significant amount of coal-fired capacity, but it's burned in a clean manner. So clean coal is good. Coal is not bad. You know, I always have to be careful because we do have a coal mine here in Alaska, and Alaska has a very significant quantity of coal, you know, beyond that is just mined. So coal burned in an environmentally responsible way is a good fuel source.
And even here on the Kenai, there are still folks, if you look in the right spot along the coast, there are still folks who will burn coal during the winter months to keep warm. Not too many left, but still a few of them there. I want to stick kind of on some of the environmental questions. Something that sticks out in my mind, and I'm curious about this as I've read about other northern projects, Arctic projects, major construction projects. As we move ahead and we get, you know, a few years down the road and everything falls into place the way it's planned to and the way folks would like it to see happen as you begin construction, another thing that is sort of always moving in one direction and not slowing down is we're getting warmer up here. And I'm really curious about what a warming Arctic means for a big construction project like this, where you're going across a lot of places that, you know, 40 years ago when the TAPS line was built, those were relatively stable places. A lot of that area is not so stable anymore when we talk about rising temperatures and what that's done to the permafrost and the ground on which a lot of this project is going to be built. How does that play into the engineering and the decision-making process in terms of materials and the path itself, and yeah, just maybe you could speak to that a little bit, because that's an ever moving kind of target, it seems like.
It is, and I've got Frank Richards here as well, who I may turn some of this over to. But the seasons are shortening a bit. A bunch of this construction will be in the wintertime. You know, ice roads are built. It's the way things are built up north. So I'm not going to say we're not impacted. I think we've taken that into account. There even has been suggestions of shipping from the north, but we're really not going to do that. We've looked at that pretty hard, and that's really not economic.
That would look similar to the Yamal Peninsula. Yeah,
similar
to
Yamal. Uh-huh. You've got to keep a berth warmed throughout the year.
Right.
But on the construction aspect, it is an impact, and I'm going to turn it over to Frank, who has dealt with that at the ground level.
And so, yeah, the shortened construction season, I have to imagine, is just one sort of piece of this overall question of a changing climate here.
You're correct. One of the things that we have to do in our filing with the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, or FERC, is look at the impacts of climate change, global warming, et cetera. And what we have done in that respect is we've actually had to look at our construction sequencing. So if we start at the top of the project, we're in Prudhoe Bay, we have to bring in large modules to be able to construct a gas treatment plant to essentially remove the CO2 that comes up with the gas as it's produced. We'll strip that out and then push that back down into the reservoir. But that construction will require modules to be built in other locations, probably in Asian fabrication yards, and then barged up into Prudhoe Bay. So the open water season for actually having those barges come into to Prudhoe Bay is really quite critical. What we're seeing is that potentially open water window now is maybe getting larger. So that helps reduce some of the risk that we had originally envisioned going in. We will design all of the components of the project to take into account the issues on permafrost, the issues of impacting heat into the permafrost and what that does in regards to potentially thawing it or trying to keep it in a more stable condition. As we look at the pipeline route, we have continuous permafrost from essentially the Arctic Ocean down through to the southern parts of the Brooks Range. And then we enter in what is called discontinuous permafrost, where you have patches of permafrost and patches of seasonally frozen ground until you get down, you know, south of the Alaska Range, where we have essentially seasonally frozen ground or non-permafrost ground. So that means that we have to, as we design the project and design the steel for the pipeline to be able to handle pipe movements, we have to make sure we put in place the appropriate steel to be able to handle those future ground, either frost heave or thaw settlement. This is one of the issues that the federal regulator who's responsible for pipeline safety is called the Pipeline Hazardous Materials Safety Administration, or PHMSA. They have made sure that any project in Alaska, any pipeline project, whether it be the Donlin Gold Mine with the natural gas being piped over from Cook Inlet, or the Alaska standalone pipeline project, which is our in-state project, or the Alaska LNG project, has in place what is known as strain-based design to make sure that the pipe, the strength of the steel, can handle the ground movement, which will impart strain into the pipe. So as you either thaw a piece of ground or the ground is heaved due to frost, you're gonna get movement in the pipe as you would. So they want to make sure that we have that sufficiently strong pipe, and we've done that. We've gone out, we've purchased pipe on the in-state project and tested it to make sure it could handle the ground movements, and lo and behold, it does. So we'll just have to make sure that as we go through those areas that we put in place suitable strength pipe to be able to handle that. Now, we also have earthquakes in Alaska as well. So we have to make sure we know where those earthquake faults are. We'll bring the pipe up out of the ground at those and put them on essentially horizontal sleepers where the pipe can move as an earthquake energy goes through. And we're following the same design that was used on the Trans-Alaska pipeline and actually went through a significant earthquake in 2002 on the Denali Fault. We're crossing the same fault. We're going to use the same design as a proven design to be able to handle it. When I talk about the construction sequencing, for the pipeline, it's about 800 miles long. We're going to have four individual pipeline spreads, about 100 and, well, nearly 200 miles each. And so we've actually looked at modifying the construction, so from summer to winter, winter to summer, so that we can actually have the more efficient flow of not only workers, but also equipment to be able to work with the seasonality going from south in Cook Inlet to north in Prudhoe Bay. So we want to make sure that we're putting in place an executable project that is most efficient and taking into account the impacts of weather delays.
That part, to me, is the one that's really interesting in terms of designing the project, and then also sort of, you know, trying to anticipate what the environment's going to look like in the future, because as you mentioned, the range of conditions through which this line will be built and through which the TAPS line exists right now is huge, is absolutely huge. And it's not going to become any more static over the next, you know, over the lifespan of this project. Are you using climate models? How does it decided sort of what the plan is, how these things are engineered, what materials are used? Is it climate models? Is it looking to other places that are similar? How do you, for a non-engineer to try to ask that question, I guess is even tough. So I'll let an engineer try to answer my silly question.
Okay. Well, it's certainly not a silly question. I think it's a major concern to the regulators that are going to be making sure that the pipeline remains safe throughout its life. And they want to make sure that we are doing our due diligence to verify that we're designing it so that it's going to be able to withstand those. So what we have, though, is when TAPS was built, it created a wealth of information. It has ground temperatures, it has trench logs, it has 10,000 boreholes along its length. We now have all that information. So we have the basic science that was collected 40 years ago. We've done subsequent field work to be able to meet the requirements of the regulatory process and our own engineering analysis to make sure that we can see the impacts over those 40 plus years and then plan for the future, you know, with predictive models, identifying how potential ground temperatures are going to increase or not, where you're going to have ground movements and how much. So the one thing I wanted to say that acronym PHMSA, or Pipeline Hazardous Materials Safety Administration, they're going to require us to do monitoring of the pipeline. So we will actually use what are known as smart pigs, or essentially devices that you put inside the pipe, and they run down the pipe, and they'll measure ground movement. So we'll be able to monitor that on a nearly annual basis to be able to see whether or not we're going to be actually reaching an area where you have more ground movement than you want, and then we'll have to remediate it. So we'll be utilizing those smart technologies in addition to the design efforts based on the sound science that we've received and the best available technology that we have now to make sure that we have built a safe product.
So as those conditions where the pipe exists, as those potentially change, you'll be able to keep track of what those changing conditions are almost in real time and then react in kind as is necessary?
we'll be able to react as those smart pigs go through the line. We'll be able to then, yes, get that information on a real-time basis, and they'll be able to then verify whether or not we've had significant movement or slight movement or no movement at all.
And is it that scene from that James Bond movie where he's stuck in the pipe and the thing's coming down at him and he has to pop out in the middle of the desert, and then from there we go on to fight the bad guy? I don't know.
That's correct.
couldn't be a conversation without a trip into James Bond for absolutely no reason. That had to do a lot with some of the environmental questions that I had and some of the things that I've been kicking around. I'm really curious. I've heard a number of presentations, you know, at Chamber of Commerce meetings and this sort of thing about financing for this project. And has the number changed? Are we still looking roughly $43-ish billion is kind of the round number?
Correct. That's for the full project.
And so, yeah, talk to me a little bit about how the financing will work. I know that we have the joint agreement with China, sort of lines some things up, kind of a handshake agreement as to how this structure might potentially work. But tell us where we are on this and where the money could potentially come from, and when we might know when some of those agreements will be a little bit more firm.
Okay, let's step back a bit. So you said about $43 billion. So it's a $27 billion construction project with all of the components. That's gas treating plant, pipeline, LNG. We've got about $6.3 billion in owner's cost, which includes about $3.4 billion for project management. That'll go to a large contractor to oversee the overall construction project. And then the project team before us that was led by Exxon, they really developed the number. And they subjected all of the major components to a Monte Carlo simulation and to see what if everything went wrong. What if this went wrong? What if things were delayed? What if there was ice flows and you couldn't move modules? And so what that resulted in is a contingency exposure that was about $7 billion. And then added on top of that was about another $1.6 billion for extra project management if everything went wrong. So you add that all together, that gets you to $43 billion. So that's the number that we've been working with. We think it's a comfortable number. We're going to look at this much like a pipeline project, and so then it becomes a non-recourse project finance project. What that means is we need significant customers with long-term agreements that agree to pay every month, you know, for 20 years, let's say. That revenue stream is what gives the banks comfortable to lend to the project. So we're looking at a capital structure that is 75% debt. So out of that 43, about 32 would be debt, supported by those long-term contracts. The equity side, similar to buying your house, you got to put some equity in to, you know, to get the mortgage, would be about 25%. So that's about $11 billion. So what we're looking for is some third-party investment, not right this moment, but in the future. Later this year, we're going to be having an introductory roadshow, which really introduces the project to the large infrastructure investors, and then go out for serious funding next year. And so if you look at it from that standpoint, what I've always said is I'd like the state to have the option to invest, but not the obligation, not the requirement. And that's really the path we're on. So what that means is we've got to make this project look attractive enough to the infrastructure investors. It's never going to have a high enough return to attract an oil company. That's why they're not involved in this project. That's not why they're not involved in other gas pipeline projects. The pipeline industry does not deliver the kind of returns that an oil company needs. So what you see is the pipeline companies in this country, gas pipeline companies, are owned by third parties that are in the pipeline business, and a lot of that funding comes from infrastructure investors that like stability, predictability, and will sacrifice some return. So we expect that here as well. I'd like to think that the state maintains its majority control of the project. The deal that we did with the three parties in the joint development agreement, that's Sinopec, Bank of China, CIC Capital, Sinopec is really the offtake buyer, so they're the customer. And then Bank of China will be leading a banking consortium that they'll pull together to be the lender for their portion, at least, of the offtake, which we expect to be 75%. And then we'll have to come up with the equity side. One of those equity investors may be the one of the Chinese investors or a consortium of Chinese investors probably around the 25% ownership level. And so that means there's another big slice, you know, for domestic investors, and then we've got, you know, the other half, let's say, that would be either state, AGDC, or could be third parties.
And you mentioned Sinopec being having signed on as wanting to be a customer of this and a major player in this. I know that recently they kind of stepped away from wanting to have a lot to do with the construction aspect. And as I understand it, that was largely a function of their, I guess, lack of expertise in dealing with this region of the world. Was that kind of why they didn't want to take such a big lead on the construction side of things?
Correct. Yeah, they have a large engineering and construction company that has built a pipeline that's actually got a higher altitude peak than ours. It's about the same distance, a little bit longer. But they do not have permafrost experience, and they've never built an LNG plant. So in our original documents, we sort of had a place for them that if they wanted to have that role for an overall project lead on the technical side, they could. They sent some teams here. They drove the route. They flew the route. They said they want to be a subcontractor, that they do not have the expertise in those two areas, which are critical areas for us, you know, the permafrost construction and then the LNG plant. So they said, don't look to us for that, but we would like to be a subcontractor.
And I want to get back to sort of what construction might potentially look like here on the ground locally and further up the line as well, but especially here locally as we're sitting in Kenai. But I'm also curious, you know, when we're talking about financing and what potentially the state's role might continue to be in that as we move ahead, how is the governor's race playing into this? What are you hearing from the candidates that make you think that there could be administration support different than it is now, or more than it is now, or less than it is now? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, and certainly, you know, it's something we're watching. We've got obviously very good support from Governor Walker. He's been really the senior diplomat on the missions. He's known by White House administration officials. He's known by the presidents of the large buying nations. I've called him affectionately my best salesman out there because he's done so well on the market side. So I you know, from a project standpoint, I'd hate to see us change horses, but at the same time, I think we've got a very good project that, as long as we get some, you know, lack of opposition, you know, support ideally, we're going to carry on with the project. And I think he's made the statement too that getting this project done is the most important thing for the state.
Looking at this realistically, you've got folks typically on the Republican side of that governor race and the folks who are running from that side. It seemed in my mind that you're going to be hearing a lot of the state needs to not be spending so much on this. If this is really truly a project that has a market and can attract investors, then it should do it. The state should stay away from it. Do rising oil prices and the effect that those have on the state budget, does that make the conversation potentially a little bit easier to have were the administration to change to an administration that maybe doesn't think this is such a great idea, but then if we're talking $100 a barrel oil, then that maybe that's an easier sell? I don't know.
Well, and, you know, certainly rising oil prices makes LNG even more attractive out there in the world. But, you know, since I've been here, we've not asked for any more dollars from the state. I've just said, you know, leave us what we've got. There was an allocation done, you know, several years ago for the two projects, Alaska LNG and the ASAP project, that's now been combined into one. I've said we'll live within that. We're going to make this project attractive to third-party investors. I think we can very easily do that. It's one of the largest proven resources on the planet. It's right in the backyard of the largest growth market for LNG. The only thing that separates them is this pipeline. But to do that, we need to not only have the project be attractive, we need to be able to receive third-party funds for those investors. I think once the state officials start to see, well, wait a minute, third parties are interested, this looks like a good project, don't leave us out, you know. And so I think that's some of the concern is, hey, we don't want to be left out either. So I think, you know, right now we're not worried so much about the funding. I really don't intend to come back to the state for funding, because I really want to make this project attractive to the third-party investors. But again, having said that, we need to make it available as well. We can't say the state does not want to invest and you're not going to be allowed to receive funds from third parties. So it's, you know, it's ideally both of those things has to happen.
Yeah. You mentioned the Alaska Standalone Pipeline, and I would be remiss if we didn't spend at least a few moments talking about that. I feel like that's a project that has gotten a lot of work put into it, a lot of investment put into it. And as the AKLNG project goes, there's a lot of useful information that's been gathered, sort of parallel with both projects. And maybe you could just kind of bring us up to speed on where ASAP is. I know there have been some regulatory developments that have happened that are pretty big steps for that project.
I can touch on that, and I'm going to touch on it, but I would be remiss if I didn't have Frank really address that, because I consider him to be the guy that's pushed ASAP forward. ASAP was our foundational project for the company, for Alaska Gas Line Development. Without the ASAP project, we may not be in the Alaska LNG project. There may not have been an Alaska LNG project. It's a beautiful body of work. The route covers about 80% of the Alaska LNG route. It is the tough part of the project, which is the pipeline piece. But I don't want to steal the spotlight from Mr. Richards.
Yeah, tell us about that, Frank. Where are we at with that, and how does it play into the hand of where AKLNG is right now?
Well, what the Alaska Standalone Pipeline Project, what it represents is the mission that the Alaska legislature gave to us when they created us back in 2010, because at that time the Cook Inlet was looking like it was in a fairly steep decline, and we had to make sure that there was going to be gas for the power generation and home heating in South Central Alaska. So they gave us that charge, and so since that time we've been developing a project. We went through an extensive amount of engineering in the 2015, completed what is known as FEED, or front-end engineering and design. And at that time, we were in the regulatory process for the Army Corps of Engineers to get the environmental impact statement complete. Well, 3 years later, now we find ourselves finally with the Corps of Engineers that have published a final environmental impact statement in the Federal Register, and we are to, in the next 2 weeks, hopefully to receive our record decision from the Army Corps of Engineers. So that is a major milestone for us as a state and for us as a corporation, because we've completed that portion of the mission. So that gives us essentially the federal authorization to construct a gas treatment plant on the North Slope and a pipeline to deliver gas for Alaskans' needs. Now, people may wonder, well, what's the difference between the two projects? Well, the Alaska Standalone Pipeline Project was really limited at the time to a smaller volume, or 500 million standard cubic feet a day, or about twice the amount that Alaska consumes on an average annual basis. While as the Alaska LNG project is a larger diameter project, and it's really the main focus is on commercialization of those North Slope natural gas resources to the world export market, in addition to providing Alaskans with energy. So that work, that body work that we've completed for the Alaska Standalone Pipeline Project is really a foundation now that we are engaging with the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission on the Alaska LNG project to be able to utilize in their separate environmental impact statement. And we're identifying that this work which was just done with the same federal agencies, with the same pipeline route for approximately 80% of the pipeline leading to Nikiski, with the same gas treatment plant on the North Slope in Prudhoe Bay, so that there's not the need to duplicate that effort. The impact to the flora, the impact of the fauna, the impact of the water has already been considered. The impact to the air in terms of air quality monitoring has been done. So why not? No sense repeating the work, no sense spending the extra money. Utilize it now. Push through Alaska LNG environmental impact statement on a more rapid time frame, because those same federal agencies, those same cooperating agencies have reviewed this very same work body. So that's where we're hoping to be able to accelerate the Alaska LNG work. And as Keith said, this project, the Alaska Standalone Pipeline Project, was the backup project should the large-scale commercialization not come to fruition and Alaskans still needed to have gas supply to South Central Alaska. So we have that body work. If there's ever the need, we'll be able to proceed forward.
Kind of a two birds with one stone approach, a little bit.
Yes.
Kind of along those same lines in terms of decisions being made and those major steps. I wanted to fast forward a little bit. I know coming up at the end of this year, the final agreements with that GDA or JDA with China, those are coming up due at the end of the year. And what are those? What kind of work is being put into making those final agreements? What will they look like? What will those agreements entail? And I guess really, what will it tell us about sort of the prospects for the project moving forward when those are done at the end of the year?
Okay, so the main focus is really the what we call the SPA, which is the sale and purchase agreement for LNG, and that again is really Sinopec as customer. That is really just for the purchase of LNG, not the investment, not the anything to do with construction or that. So that really forms the commercial foundation, and then on top of that, we've got the if there is an investment agreement. We'll try and fit that within that time frame, but the real driver, the real focus, is that commercial offtake agreement. That is the document that underpins all of these LNG projects or even pipeline projects. Once you have that in place, then it becomes much more easy to finance the projects and get investors, that type of thing. As I said, we've sort of got the placeholder out there for the Chinese consortium to own about 25% of the project, so they would be in a minority position, and we would expect that to continue. They will not be in a majority control position, so they may have 75% of the capacity of the system, but not the ownership. And so those are very distinct things. But a lot of focus now on the those definitive agreements, as we call them, and the end of the year is the target. And so right now they've got the ability to step into 75% of the capacity. If those agreements are not done by the end of the year, they might lose that ability for that quantity. We're pricing this project like an infrastructure project, so it's somewhat unique in the energy world. It doesn't have the volatility like oil or like most of the LNG in Asia has, which is tied to oil. We're pricing this more like a pipeline, very stable, very predictable. What we found is that's very attractive to the Asian utility buyers. So most of the LNG in the world is bought by large utilities, either gas or electric utilities. And those utilities have millions of customers. And those millions of customers typically do not have their incomes fluctuate with oil. So if they can have their major household expenses, of which energy is one, also be relatively stable like their incomes, then everybody becomes much happier.
And it starts with that base of sort of solidarity of utility customers paying all their bills on time. Take that times millions of customers, and then those utilities are able to pay for those exports on time and to everyone's satisfaction.
Correct, right. And those utilities are also large infrastructure projects. So you got to lay a lot of pipeline, a lot of stations, a lot of interconnects, so they like that long-term predictability, just like we do on our pipeline.
So when you say infrastructure investors, that's a fairly new term to me, and the idea it seems to be that they're looking for potentially in trade of a slightly smaller return over time, being slightly more guaranteed of that return as opposed to the ups and downs of other major commodity markets.
Correct. So if you have retirement funds, let's say in a retirement account or a mutual fund, if you look at the companies they're invested in, many of them will have investments in utilities, in pipeline companies, toll roads, infrastructure, stuff that just keeps paying over long term, not a lot of volatility. You don't get the wild upswings. It's not going to be a 90% return 1 year, but it's stable every year. And so it's very good for those retirement accounts, those pension funds, the insurance companies.
So we've talked a little bit about the things that are going on right now and how 2018 has gone. And we mentioned that there are some major agreements coming up that will be sort of hopefully wrapped up by the end of the year. Let's go ahead and say that all that happens just like it's supposed to. What are we looking at for 2019, 2020, the immediate future in terms of what comes next, and specifically, what will that mean for the different points along the project, both on the North Slope and down here on the peninsula?
Okay, so we've got lots of paperwork in front of us for 2019.
I can only imagine.
Yes, in the front part of 2020. The long lead item is really the FERC process, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission process. They've given us a schedule now, which is a significant event. That says you'll get a draft by March of 2019, a final EIS by December of 2019, and then You've got an appeal process. Then we expect the record of decision in like March of 2020. So that will most likely be the last item and is typically the last item that these LNG projects wait for before they can begin construction, because what you actually get from FERC is an authorization to construct. And so you cannot actually do much of the site construction work until you have that. However, you can do a lot of work that's needed to precede that construction, like long lead procurement items, you know, ordering space in a pipe mill, ordering space in turbine mill, you know, turbine yards, that type of thing. The FERC will also let you do some site prep work before the authorization to construct. So what I'm hoping for is in that 2019 period, we have enough clarity on the, once we get the draft environmental impact statement, and we've done enough work with the investors and the customers, that we get some funding to do that long lead work, some of the detailed engineering, some of the, you know, ordering of materials. And potentially, if we got enough, had enough confidence, we could actually start construction of modules, which are going to be done offshore. And then, you know, much of the work up north is modules that then get floated in place. So we'll start to see real activity, hopefully at the back half of 2019. But between now and then, we've got the paperwork, we've got the road shows, we've got definitive agreements, and expect some of that visibility to come out this year. And then some at the first half of next year.
Go ahead, Frank.
Frank's got a comment.
Well, I'd say, so if locally from the Kenai Peninsula Borough, what we see is that we had made a selection on the Kenai Spur Highway alternative around the new plant location. So we're going to be going out and doing our initial engineering and design of that. We'll be talking to the affected property owners about their needs and going forward in terms of acquiring the property for that reroute. So that will involve doing right-of-way survey through those lands. We've done some noise monitoring already. We'll have to do some environmental work along the route. So there'll be actually boots on the ground taking a place here towards the end of this year. And then we're also going to go upstream from Nikiski and look at the other private landowners between here and Prudhoe Bay. Now, most of this line, most of this pipeline is on state and federal land. So approximately, I'll say 90% of the land is owned by a municipal, state, or federal government. So that remaining 10% are private landowners, native corporations included, that we're going to have to negotiate with for land rights to be able to place the pipeline, including in Prudhoe Bay. So from north to south, we have property acquisition. We are going to have FERC coming out to the Kenai Peninsula and public comment period when they publish the draft EIS in early 2020. So there'll be opportunity then for Kenai residents or borough residents to come in and weigh in and give their insights into what they think this project should be.
Now, I'm sorry, yeah, go ahead, Keith.
Well, I wanted to add one thing too, and that is one of the things we've said really to the communities and the contractors and the labor force here is you've got to get ready as well. So we're doing a lot of stuff, but don't wait until a month before start of construction to say, well, wait a minute, you know, I want to be involved. Start thinking about what your company does now. Get ready for a big, you know, construction project to come into town, because every single contractor is going to be impacted. The amount of the impact and the slice of the pie they get is going to be somewhat dependent upon how prepared they are. We have a luxury right now that this is Alaska's project. We're in control. So now we can say Alaska first and actually implement it. Same with the labor. You know, we're looking at a project labor agreement that lets us do some legal, you know, maneuvers to actually make Alaska hire first. So we want to do that. It's somewhat of a luxury that we really want to take advantage of and make good on. But there is a burden on those contractors and labor force to get ready, get trained. You know, don't listen to the naysayers. Let's get ready for this project.
What kind of a lead time? I mean, realistically, what kind of a lead time will you be looking at in terms of nailing down who your contractors and subcontractors are going to be? You know, actually finding people to fill those boots that are going to be on the ground.
Well, some of the large contractors we're going to be interviewing this year may even engage some large contractors this year. But the subcontractors will really come more next year. What we want is to interface with those large contractors and say, look, here's a list of companies, here's what they do, in Alaska, if you have a need for one of these things, go to these guys first before you think about going outside.
Now, one.
Go ahead, Frank. And again, I say that would be key to Alaskans to be able to identify what their expertise is, what supplies they can provide, what construction abilities that they have. So it's the, as Keith said, it's the ability for Alaskans to be able to prepare and sell their opportunities and what they can actually achieve, not only to provide it to AGDC, but also for us to be able to turn it over to potentially these large international construction firms that will be taking the project through its next major phase.
Yeah, and in terms of keeping things local and looking at what folks can be sort of looking forward to in terms of opportunity, a big part of the discussion I know early on, and I feel like it's gotten a little bit lost in the shuffle as we've gotten a little bit closer to this and we've seen some deadlines come and some major progress be made. What I'm not hearing a lot of just right at this moment is what a federal payment in lieu of taxes would mean for the Kenai Peninsula Borough. That was something I know a few years back when we were talking about pre-FEED stuff, that was huge. What is this? How is all this going to get paid for? These impacts to the community, how are they going to be paid for? What do we know right now about payment in lieu of taxes, or a PILT, as it's more commonly known? Are we anywhere close to the point in the project where those sorts of things are even being discussed, and what they would look like?
Yes. So this is Frank. The payment in lieu of taxes for those folks on the air is when AGDC was created by the legislature, they gave us a tax exempt status. So therefore, the infrastructure that we would build would not be able to be taxed by local or municipal governments. So what the conversation is and what the legislature directed was that the Department of Revenue form a group called the Municipal Advisory Group to be able to look at the alternatives to taxes, and that's called Payment in Lieu of Taxes, or PILT. So they had worked previously when the project was being led by ExxonMobil, they had formulated a group that included the Kenai Peninsula Borough and the North Slope Borough and the Denali Borough and the Fairbanks North Star Borough, and to be able to come up with a number that they felt was reasonable to cover the impacts to those communities in lieu of a tax payment by the project proponents. So that covers such things as increased police services or increased hospital or fire and safety or road impacts or school impacts. So that number was put forward by the producers. Now, when AGDC assumed control of this project in 2017, again, that board essentially went silent. So now the Department of Revenue is now going to be recasting that board. They'll be working with those borough governments as well as the municipal governments and other interested parties to say, here's what we think the distribution may be. Here's an amount. In conjunction with AGDC, we'll let them know if it's economic or not. But then that will then set the stage for how individual communities or affected parties along the route would then receive some benefit during the impact period during construction, as well as with long-term operations.
So a ways to go before we know sort of what that number is and how it would be divvied out?
Well, I think that the Department of Revenue is, again, reconstituting that board very quickly. Our goal and our discussions with them is that they do this on a rapid basis, and hopefully they'll be presenting something to the legislature early in 2019.
That's 2019 is a little bit closer maybe than we think it is. I'm sure that's true for you guys as well. We've got just a couple minutes left here. I can't believe it's been an hour already, but I guess just to sort of close up, what are the things that you find, we'll just say it, for the next year as we get into 2019 and potential big milestones coming up in the next year, what are the things that you are looking forward to as being the big milestone, and what are you trying to avoid or you hope would be avoided to seeing that big milestone happen?
Well, we've got a number of parallel paths running. So we've got milestones on each of those paths, but certainly one of the big ones is the commercial offtake agreements. So that sets the foundation. The regulatory path is a very big one that we cannot construct anything until we get that approval. So we expect to see some milestones occur there, as I said, in 2019. And then the financing is really in the middle of that. So we've got that equity roadshow that we want to do. I'm excited about that and really introducing the project. It'll be the first time that we've really introduced the project to potential infrastructure investors. Outside of that, we also have the gas supply agreements, which are moving well. We did announce a memorandum with BP, so that's a precedent agreement, binding precedent agreement, so that was good. We've got two more to go, but those are moving well as well. So you put that all together, we've got some good milestones this year and next. It seems like it can never move fast enough. As Frank said, we've also got the activity on the ASAP project that is an interesting sort of dynamic that now gives us some additional room to maneuver, you know, both on the project design, but also at FERC. We can have them look at something that's already been approved under the Trump administration. They're pretty serious about not being duplicative in the work. So ideally, the FERC will really look at that body of work to accelerate our process. But all seems to be going well. The only, you know, if there is a little bit of a worry, you know, it's maybe on this broader tariff trade issue. But what I keep saying is if we do more projects like the project that we're talking about here with Alaska, you know, selling to China, we would not have a trade deficit. And if you look at Alaska from a broader picture that we really haven't talked about, you know, Alaska is a big resource state. You got China as a big resource buyer. So this project to me is sort of, you know, is a foundational building block in a much longer relationship that I'm hoping will blossom into other resource development projects as well. And again, the more of these projects we do, the less of a trade imbalance we have.
And yeah, go ahead, Frank.
Well, one thing I would add for the listeners is, again, to be prepared for this huge project to come down the pike and hopefully be able to participate in it, folks need to be able to look to see what are their desires in working on the project. So there's going to be a lot of training that's going to have to take place to be able to make sure that the folks have the skill sets necessary to be able to be working and working efficiently on the project. So if someone has interest in cooking, if they have interest in pipe welding, if they have interest in, you know, equipment operation, that they get themselves skilled up and ready to be able to then come and participate in this project to make it efficient and beneficial for all Alaskans.
And the very last question that I have, I'm glad you mentioned that. That's something we've covered a lot here locally is what folks are doing to kind of prepare for this and thinking about it long term. But the very last question that I have, and I apologize because I didn't even think about it until just now. I haven't checked gas prices on the international market or at the Henry Hub for a couple of weeks, so I'm not sure exactly what the number is today. But all of this, of course, hinges on what the price of gas is. And is there a number at which we know that this project pencils out or doesn't pencil out? And what is that number? Are we there?
Well, there are certainly numbers that we're focused on. If I was going to throw out a number, it's about $8 landed in the beach of Asia. One of our competitors is the U.S. Gulf Coast, and that's a Henry Hub number plus $5. So it takes about $5 to move gas from Henry Hub to the liquefaction, you know, plants on the coast, liquefy the gas, put the gas on a boat, send it across the water, pay the Panama Canal. So that gets you a number of about $8. A lot of the LNG in Asia is traded on a percentage of crude, percentage of Brent, anywhere from, you know, 11% to 12-13%. That's come down from previous years. So if you do that same math, you know, on a $60 to $70 barrel, you're about that $8. Currently, LNG is just shy of 10, but it does have some volatility in that pricing. But if you look at a long-term project, you ought to be looking more in that $8-ish range. So that's the kind of a number we're focused on for the long term. We think that provides a reasonable return for equity investors, pays the debt, and makes the customer happy as well.
All right, very good. Well, we're out of time today, but Keith Meyer and Frank Richards from Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation, thanks so much for your time today and stopping by. Pleasure to have you in the studio today.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.